Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Learning from Smart People. I have a feeling that you are going to learn some good stuff today. My smart person is Michael Davis, and he helps you overcome fear, anxiety, or negative experiences to become a confident, influential, and persuasive speaker. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Rob. I got to tell you, being a speaking consultant and trainer and having been on other podcasts, you have such a terrific, soothing voice.
Well,
love for you to read some audiobooks for me so I can just go to sleep at night. Not that you're boring. I just relax me.
There you go. Well, thank you very much. That's a huge compliment coming from someone that does this for a living and it's got some expertise in that area. I am hoping that, as you said, my voice is not so soothing that I just put everyone to sleep. So, hey, you know.
Not at all. No. All right.
So, yeah, the greatest advertisement for the Learning from Smart People podcast ever. Like, hey, if you're having trouble sleeping, this is the one that will fix all of your insomnia issues. So, cool. So let's start with kind of your backstory, because you didn't start out in the speaking industry. You started out doing financial planning, if I'm not mistaken. So can you talk about how you got to be a financial planner and then the transition from there to working with people on their speaking?
Yeah, I fell into financial planning. I was in my mid-20s and I didn't know what I wanted to do. A friend of my dad's was selling insurance. I started off setting appointments for a guy in the insurance industry long before we had cell phones that would, you know, block anybody coming through the sales calls you didn't want. And that's how I got started.
Okay.
And about 10 years into my career, I was asked to give workshops and presentations. And I did an absolutely lousy job at it. So badly that my boss literally said to me, "This is a problem. Fix this or else."
Wow.
Yeah. It was a real touchy-feely guy. And that scared me to death. So I went and I had to figure this out. How do I become a more effective speaker? And it turns out I had some childhood experiences in front of audiences that uncovered, and I had to deal with all that. But eventually I discovered I had a knack for speaking. I just didn't know how. Like most people, I thought it was a skill you were born with.
Right. You know, it's so funny to hear you say that, because I'll tell you, you know, I am a speaker. It's what I do for a living.
Yeah.
But I started off speaking in church. So I was like 16, 17 years old. And I remember my best friend and I had an opportunity to speak in church for the very first time in front of our home audience. And, you know, it's all people that have known us our whole lives. And after we got done, both of us, we were about as down and depressed as you could be, because we were both of the opinion, like, we had an opportunity and we blew it. We were terrible. And And I think, and maybe you can help me with this, but I think a lot of people have that experience where, like, I'm passionate about something. I've got something I want to share. There's something I want to communicate. But when you get the opportunity to share it, it doesn't go well. Is that kind of a universal, or is that, what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And I find it's one of two reasons that people have a hard time effectively speaking. One is they've had a bad experience like I did, and you had to learn how to overcome that. That creates a lot of fear and anxiety. The other problem is they have so much passion for their topic that they go on and on and on, and they do what I call the lunch buffet effect. Back in the old days before COVID, we would go to these buffets and we would get our plate of food and sit down and start to eat. And we'd say, this is really good. And $10 is a lot of money to pay for a plate of food. I think I'll go get more.
Right.
So about three plates later, we sit back and we're stuffed. That's how it worked at buffets. That's why I call this the lunch buffet effect, because these speakers are so excited about their topic. They just throw everything at us. We might be entertained. We might have a little bit more information, but we don't know what to do because there's so much.
That's really interesting. So what I'm hearing you say is that there needs to be kind of a plan for what do you want your audience to take away from this? What, whether it, is it like information? Is it sales? It all depends, obviously, on who you are and who you're speaking to, right?
Agreed. Stephen Covey said it in the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, begin with the end in mind. In my own speeches and stories and any of my clients I work with, I always start with the question, what do you want your audience to think, feel, or do differently when you're done? It can't be three actions, by the way. It has to be one.
Okay.
It might be something as simple as sign up for a one-to-one meeting, sign up for my newsletter, let's buy a product, whatever it is, be very clear about that one next step is.
Okay. So you just mentioned something there, and I'm curious as to, you mentioned speeches and stories. How Yes. important are stories in your presentations?
I believe stories are the critical piece of all presentations. Whether it's at a networking event, you have 30 seconds to let people know what you do. If it's part of a keynote address or a sales presentation, they are the core because, and this is, it's almost, it has become cliche at this point, Rob, we are wired for stories. That knowledge is not enough. We've got to know how to give stories, but they are the critical piece that connect us to prospective clients or people we're trying to influence.
Okay. Can you help my listeners with this? Because we have all had people who told stories and we were riveted by their stories. And you have also heard people tell a story and you're like, I think I could have told that story in 10 seconds and it took them 10 minutes, or they just ramble on and on. And so can you help people, like, are there guidelines for storytelling, or, you know, how do you develop that skill set?
I like this question because I'm always afraid to answer, hey, there's this one way to do it, because there is no one way to do anything effectively. With that said, I will tell you, and I just wrote this article today, there are five common elements of the most memorable and persuasive stories. A relatable character who gets pushed out of his or her ordinary life, what I call an inciting incident.
Okay.
Because of that, the character creates a new goal.
Okay.
In pursuit of that, that's the second step. First is the character, second is the goal. The third step is, because of this new goal and being out of their ordinary life or their comfort zone, they encounter conflict and challenge and obstacles along the way to accomplishing that goal. So challenges and conflict are the number three part. In that part of the journey, there is a guide who comes along and says, here's some wisdom. Here's a new way to think of things, grasshopper. Try this. And one of the challenges I see with a lot of stories, Rob, is that people say, okay, I got the new wisdom, and the next day everything was great. No, it wasn't. It was still tough, because anytime we try a new action or activity, it's uncomfortable. But the guide told us this will work, so we trust the guide. We keep taking the new action, and one day it gets comfortable. And it gets more comfortable. And eventually we get to the point of the fourth part of the story, which is the moment of success. We have to show that moment when this character who's gone through this journey of struggle, we need to see that person succeed. Because if we don't, it's like watching a sporting contest and missing the last 2 minutes of a close game. What happened? Our brains are thinking, well, what did you do to me? You didn't let me see the end. That's not where we need to stop, though. Because if we just show that moment of success, it leaves the question, okay, was that just a fluke? Was it a one-time thing? Or has this person truly changed? Because all great stories are about transformation. Mm. So the fifth part is, we need to see the new life of this character. Has this person, because of this journey and eventual success, has she changed? Is she living a new and better life? And now she can provide wisdom to people who are in her circle of influence. So those are the five steps that all memorable stories have.
It's really amazing. I think a lot of times we tell stories that in which we are the hero of the story, you know, like, this is what I did, and this is what I said, and this is, and the story's all about me. And what you're saying is that the story is about an individual who's struggling, who has an issue, who has a goal that they're trying to reach, then someone else comes along, and the hero of the story is the someone else, is the guide, is the person that gives them the tool for that. And that's, to me, in my experience, that's contrary to a lot of the stories that I hear. How do you help people to get out of their own way to say, this story's not about you, it's actually about how you can relate to your audience?
Well, I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to partially agree with what you just said, because there are several types of stories. There's a lot of confusion, and I've heard storytelling experts disagree about this, the term hero and the term guide. The term hero, it is the label we put on the person who goes through this journey. The guide is the person who provides the wisdom. Well, in business, we should be the guide who provides the wisdom to the customer or the client whose story we're telling. However, in my origin story, where I told you that I was a financial advisor and I was giving these workshops and they were terrible and I had to deal with some old childhood experience, I was the hero in that story.
Right.
Because it was a journey of struggle. Now, I ran through that story fairly quickly. I had some guides along the way who told me, first of all, you have the skill to do this. I met those people in Toastmasters and the National Speakers Association.
Okay.
I was the hero in that. So it may sound like I'm nitpicking. It depends on the type of story you're telling. If you tell what I refer to as the origin story, it should be about you.
Right.
Because that relates you to the people who are listening to you. However, if you're in a business setting and you're trying to attract new clients, you're far better off being the guide because you have the solution to the problem that prospective client has.
Okay. So let me clarify what I said, because I understand it. You know, it's the hero's journey and all of those things. Sure. But what I mean is, who is the good guy? Who's the star of the whole thing? Okay. And so for me, you know, I have a spinal cord injury when I was 21 and had to learn, you know, reevaluate life, reevaluate how I connected with people. And I had, my guide was my occupational therapist, who said, you know, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I don't know what I'm capable of. You help me set the goals and I'll reach those. She said, you tell me what you want to do and we'll work to do that. And so you may not do it like you used to, you may not do it like everybody else, but with enough creativity and persistence, you'll be able to accomplish that. And so that has really gotten me to where I am today. So from a technical perspective, I'm the hero on the journey. She's the guide. But to me, the star, the person that gets the credit in that, and that's her. All right. And I guess that's where I was using the term hero. Who is really the good guy in the story? Who's the person that says, this is the person that finds the solution? And I guess my point in that is, not that I was a bad guy in the story, but I was the vehicle on which the good guy, you know, rode and kind of changed the journey. And that's, I guess that's what I was trying to say. Do you follow what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. And I agree with you 100%. You're both the good guy in that story. And because you're a professional speaker, I know that your story is impacting the audience. Here's what's great about your guide in your story, your physical therapist. So you said female?
She.
Okay. Yep. She is impacting audiences through you, people she'll never meet.
Yes.
Here's the problem that I see in most stories that don't stick is the speaker tries to be the hero and the guide.
Mm.
You can be either one equally effective. If you try to be both, people walk away thinking, well, that was really good, but you're special.
Yeah.
None of us woke up one day with all the answers.
Right. That's so interesting because you're right. How many times have you heard a story? And then, so I woke up one day and I resolved to do this. And now I'm a multi-bazillionaire because of my own self-awareness and my own resolve. And you're like, that I can never do that because I'm not like them.
That's the biggest problem. And I see this, my partner, she's in real estate, and I've gone to some of those real estate conferences with her. And that industry is filled with people who you would think were touched by the hand of God at birth. I mean, they might mention a problem or two they had, but it was so fleeting. Their life is so good. And it's like, that's, I can't relate to that. And neither can people in the audience.
Yeah. And I think part of that, and this kind of goes to social media in some ways, right? When people post on social media, they rarely share bad news on mm-hmm. social media. It's like, look at me and look at what I've done and look at my accomplishments. And that they leave out the struggle part of it. Or if they share the struggle with you, then there's a lot of times they're sharing how they themselves are both hero and guide.
Yes.
Do you see a difference in the world when you're dealing with those in-person experiences and when you're dealing with the online experiences, whether it's social media or Zoom or anywhere like that? What are your experiences with that?
Well, the biggest challenge, and I will step back for a moment with your question, Rob, and say I was very fortunate. Back in 2017, my mentor asked me to host a weekly
Zoom
virtual call.
Okay.
Brain fart for a moment. Virtual call, which we're doing right now.
Right.
He asked me to host this, and I was reluctant because I had no experience, and I was afraid I was going to hurt his brand by being a poor host. And in the beginning, I was lousy. I mean, it was terrible. I had no idea what this Zoom was, but he kept putting me out there. Like any good mentor, he saw in me what I couldn't see. And I kept doing it over and over. And by the time the pandemic and lockdown hit, I had over 300 experiences online. And I set all that up because what I'm seeing is that people are treating the camera the same way they do a live audience. We can't do that because the audience, both us as presenters and speakers and the audience, are working on a two cylinders of a five cylinder engine, meaning five senses that we have, only sight and sound are enabled when we're online. When we're presenting to a live group, we can see the room, hear the room, feel the room, smell the room, taste the room if there's food in it. Three of those are turned off when we're in front of that camera, and that makes it very hard on everybody. And we can't just speak to the camera the whole time, nor can we hide behind slides. We have to engage our audiences much faster. We have to change it up every 3 to 4 minutes at most to keep their attention. And that's the biggest difference I'm seeing, is that too many folks haven't figured this out, that we have to be different on camera. It can't be about us. It can't be about slides. It has to be a whole combination, a whole new stew, if you will, of activities.
Yeah. Okay. And again, I'll use the church example. A lot of times what has happened when churches have moved to the virtual experience or even the hybrid experience, it's just you take the pastor and he stands in front of the lectern and you put a camera in front of him and he does the exact same thing virtually that he did, in person. And in some ways, like, that's not bad. In some ways, that's what you expect from church. But in the business world, it's not the same. So can you talk about how do you make up for the loss of those other three senses, or how do you create an experience that engages the other senses?
It starts before the official start time of your event. Open that room up and start getting people to contribute through the chat box, maybe ask some questions, nothing to do with the topic at hand. Just get people engaged. And it also, as a presenter, lets you know who's going to be who are the people who will be engaged and who might be the ones hanging back. Nothing wrong with either one. We just need to know. It would help us. All right. So get them engaged right away. Have some music in the background before you start. Once you begin, get them going with questions as soon as possible. Don't ask the heavy, serious, or in-depth questions up front. Just use that chat box to get them involved. There's a term that I haven't heard anybody else use, I started using this year, called Chatbox Extroverts. There are some people who just have a need to be in that chat box. Let them do it. You don't want to alienate them. But you can't just depend on that little box over there. Sometimes there are a lot of people who don't want to go there. They still want their voice to be heard. Polls are very good in the middle of your presentation, or the breakout room, depending on the size of your audience. I love the breakout room because that's where the best ideas come from.
Yeah. So what you're doing is, at least from my experience and what I'm seeing you say, is that it goes from being a one-way stream in which information is just going out to, it goes to a didactic conversation. It goes two ways, where now people are being engaged in chat, and in the breakout rooms, people are able to share with each other. And it's not just being receivers of information, but it's also being responders. Is that an accurate summation?
It absolutely is. They have to walk away feeling they were part of an experience. Because if all we're going to do is talk at them in the virtual world, we're better served, and so are they, by putting all the information on a PDF, sending it out in an email, and saving them time.
Yeah. But you've had the same experience. When we were doing in-person presentations, there was somebody that would come and they would have a PowerPoint, and the PowerPoint was incredibly detailed and it was loaded with information, and all they did was read the slides. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you felt like, okay, you know what? If you had just sent me the PowerPoint, I could have read it myself and I could have saved all of the energy to actually get here to hear what you had to say. So there is the need to not just do what's necessary to get it done, but to figure out how can I effectively use the tools that I have to make this something that will be memorable, and to make this something that you were talking about. What is it that you want your audience to do? What is the one thing that I want to see come out of this? And how do I use the tools at hand to get my audience to do the one thing that I want?
Exactly. And you bring really good points, Rob. And it makes me think, this is a point that I make to all my clients when we first start working together, is like, audiences don't want information from you. If they want information, they've got it right here in the palm of their hand in this phone, far more information than you'll be ever to give them. What they need from you is your experience, your perspective on that topic. How do you give that to them? Through stories.
Yeah. Okay. You're spot on, and you're preaching to the choir. You're speaking my language. So I love that. I want to go back to something though that you said earlier. You were saying about your partner being in real estate.
Yes.
And with your partner being in real estate, when you listen to realtors talk, you would think that, you know, they've been touched with the hand of God from birth, I think is what you said. When it comes to speaking, there are a lot of people that feel the same way. There are some people, and they're just born naturally with the ability to speak and to communicate effectively. Where do you fall in that understanding? Are speakers born, or is it something that's innate in some people and other people just don't have the skill set, or is it something that can be taught?
Well, this goes to a question I ask a lot of people now, is who do you think make more effective speakers, extroverts or introverts? And I don't really like labeling people. I don't think very few people are one extreme or the other, but there's a reason for the question. And I almost always hear extroverts. I say, really? Tell me about that. Well, they love to talk. And I said, that's their problem. Just because somebody's good at talking or speaking does not make that individual an effective communicator. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, it is absolutely a skill that is learnable. My mindset when I was struggling as an advisor giving those workshops and getting horrible reviews was that, oh, well, I wasn't born that way. I'm no good. No, the best speakers in the world, many of them, are introverts who are afraid to, or were afraid at one point, to stand in front of a group and speak. One of my mentors is a world champion speaker, one of the best out there. When he was 6 years old, he had a horrible lisp. The father of a friend of his told him, you should not talk in public because you sound like Daffy Duck.
Oh, That's so
for
bad.
4 years. It was horrible. For 4 years, he didn't talk. Yeah. He ended up as a world champion of public speaking. He learned.
Sure. What? Okay. So I'm old enough that there used to be advertisements for a company called E.F. Hutton, yeah, right? And when E.F. Hutton talks, everybody listens. And the, to me, the reason for that is they're not talking all the time, and they have something to say whenever they talk. And that's, I think that goes, when people want to speak, they're kind of the opinion like, hey, I love to speak. I you know, just put a microphone in front of me and away I go. The issue with that is that there needs to be content behind it. And maybe, and this is my last question for you, but maybe sometimes introverts are the ones who are thoughtful about what they have to say. And as a result of that, because they're not just bubbling at the mouth, which they are, what they have to say carries a lot more weight with it. What's your reaction there?
Yes. And if you're listening to this, I am not knocking extroverts. I am one when I need to be, and I'm an introvert when I want to be. I'm both. However, just talking to the problem I have, and when somebody says to me they want to hire me and say, oh, I just love to talk, I know I've got my work cut out for me.
Yeah. So
because I think it is important to be thoughtful and think it out, and how do I want to structure this and know what I want people to think, feel, or do when I'm differently? What's the one or two points I want to get across? I'm not 10.
Sure. Yeah. So well, let me just say it this way. I'm thinking extroverts. It's the encouragement to say you need to be thoughtful before you verbalize. Yes. And the introverts, it's more you need to verbalize the thoughts that are going on in your mind, right? That's probably a way oversimplification, but what's your thought?
I believe in simplicity. Yeah, and it's telling the introvert you really do have something important to say. This is my partner. She's helped me with this too. She's an introvert, and she has felt a long time in her life that people don't want to hear what she has to say. And I've had to convince her, yes, they do. They just need to shut up long enough to listen to you.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. Hey, listen, Michael, thank you. I really appreciate you being here. If people want to learn more about you, what's the easiest way to connect with you, or how does that work?
Yeah, I have a virtual business card, I call it. And I guess we'll put this in the show notes too. But
absolutely.
It's Inphone, INPHONE/speakingCPR. Okay. I'm sorry, Inphone.co/speakingCPR. And I'll send that to you. Go to that and you can download. I've got a resource called 52 Storytelling Tips. It gives you a weekly 5-minute audio lesson on storytelling. I've got free reports. If you have any questions of me, you can click on a button and set up a phone call with me. Happy to do that with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely include that in the show notes. I would encourage people to learn from you, and whether it's the engagement of just getting some tips or the engagement of actually literally working with you and becoming a client, all highly encouraged. I appreciate you being with me today. It is time for 3 questions to establish your humanity. Are you ready for these, my friend?
I think I am.
Okay. What is your favorite book to read?
Because of the work I do in storytelling, I continually go back to a book called Storytelling Made Easy by a gentleman named Michael Haig. Michael is he was a Hollywood scriptwriting consultant for years. He was hired by people like Will Smith. So, I mean, he's had a lot of impact out there, and he's been a mentor to me. And I just love the insights I go through. So I'm obsessed with my topic, and I love that book.
Hey, not a problem at all. I love it. So in your car, what are the 2 most popular radio stations when you're in the car traveling? And that can, I mean, these days, I don't know if anyone still, you know, some people still listen to regular old AM, FM radio, although I don't know if anyone listens to AM radio. Easy question. What are the 2 most popular music channels that you will have in your car?
Well, I do go off my phone, and I listen to a lot of Audible books.
Okay.
and YouTube Music. I grew up, my parents surrounded me with music growing up, and I will listen to it. And I don't have any one particular band. I'm classic rock, any type of rock. There are very few types of music I won't listen to. Opera, I'm not a big fan of that.
Okay. No problem. So just as if you're listening to classic rock, is there a particular song that will make you sing along every time it comes on?
Yeah, the first one that jumps to mind is Bohemian Rhapsody.
And how can you not sing along with Queen, right? That song is a thing of beauty. And, yes, you know, and watching the recent Freddie Mercury bio that came out, you know, the fact that they didn't want, the producers didn't want to do that. But anyway, it was a thing of beauty.
It was opposite. And you know, it's funny. I was listening. I live in Cincinnati. Cincinnati Bengals fan. At the stadium yesterday, they were singing Bohemian Rhapsody in between quarters.
It's funny. I'm from Pittsburgh, and so our game yesterday was on late, so we watched the Bengals game and saw that very thing. They showed on TV. Here they are singing Bohemian Rhapsody. That's funny. All right, last thing for you. We're starting the new year, and what is the one food that if you were going to make a New Year's resolution that says this is my guilty pleasure and it's probably not good for me and I need to give it up, what would be the one food on your New Year's resolution to say this is probably not the healthiest, but it's something I really enjoy?
Just one. Well, there are several, but the one that's really not that healthy, and if you're from Cincinnati, you can appreciate this, is called Skyline Chili. Chili is unique to our city, and I really should give it up, but I ain't gonna.
Okay, so I know a little bit. How many ways do you do your chili? Like, because you can do it two ways, up to five, or I don't know how many more ways you can do it.
If you're listening to this, you're not familiar with Cincinnati chili. It's actually started by Greek families who came over, and there's this special recipe, and it's got chocolate in it and cinnamon, and you don't taste the chocolate. It's just a critical ingredient, but you can do it two ways, which is just the chili on spaghetti. Three way is you got cheese. And that we call that crack cheese here in town because there's something about it's addictive. Four way is either beans and onions, and then five way is the whole thing: the chili, spaghetti, cheese, beans, and onions. And I know it shortens my life every time I have one, and I don't care.
Right. Okay. And listen, for anyone who's not from Cincinnati or who has not been there, don't knock it until you try it. Hey, Michael Davis, thank you so much for being with me today. You are indeed a smart person. For all my listeners, I would encourage you, go ahead, check out Michael's website, check out his giveaways, and I would encourage you to work with him. In the meantime, I will remind you that when you stop learning, you stop living. Have a great day, everybody.